from the studios of Farm Journal Broadcast.
Information.
Conversations.
Straight talk with a dose of common sense.
Sound judgment and practical manners.
Farm Sense, the biggest topics facing agriculture and rural America.
With journalist and farm broadcaster Clinton Griffiths.
Hello and welcome to another Farm Sense podcast. I am host Clinton Griffiths, also host of Ag Day Television, where each Friday you can hear a Farm Sense from me. Today we want to talk about one of the most interesting stories in agriculture that is kind of flying under the radar. This is happening without a lot of publicity, without a lot of people knowing about it, but every day it seems like we are making new and incredible strides into the world of technology and the way that it influences plant biology and what we can do to protect our plants, to protect our farmers and our industry from things like diseases or drought or floods or what have you, just to create a more sustainable environment. Right now, there's no more dire story in agriculture than the fight against citrus greening in Florida. Once the nation's largest citrus industry, the state has seen production fall by more than 70%. Millions of dollars in research money has been spent looking for a solution. And just last month, a report came out saying a silver bullet cure is extremely unlikely. Well, now it seems like there's hope. USDA releasing the review of a genetically engineered virus that fights the greening disease. APHIS says it's modified to produce proteins from spinach, helping to prevent greening, and it won't harm the environment or pose a threat to human health. Working to solve this issue is Tim Eirich. He's the Vice President of Research and Commercialization with Southern Garden Citrus Nursery. Tim, how big has this problem gotten?
Well, if you look at all the data out there now, we believe we're 100% infected in all groves. So every grove in the state, commercial grove in the state, has a disease. And probably close to 100% infected of every tree in a grove has it, except for maybe where we have new plantings.
And even though you've done some work, you've learned a lot in the last 10 years, this is still a problem, right? The long-term, the health of the industry there in Florida, this is still an issue. You know, the reason that we're talking with you is because you kind of have some interesting leads on something that might help. Talk about some of the research you're doing and where you think it might go.
Well, Southern Gardens, being that we're a large citrus growing operation, was very forward thinking and very visionary at the beginning of all this, and saying, okay, what's this disease all about? Has it ever been cured anywhere in the world? And as we studied it and investigated it, we found it wasn't. And then really two gentlemen before me, one is still on my team and the other one is retired, but Rick Kress and Mike Irie really learned about the disease and went looking for ways to find a solution and find a cure. And we were able to work with with Texas A&M University, Dr. Eric Murkoff, and what he was doing around spinach defense and proteins. And every plant, actually every human and every mammal has these proteins. It's our first line of defense when a pathogen comes in either to our bodies or into a plant. We create these defenses to help fight those diseases off. Eric identified several of them in spinach.
So in spinach, liked the idea, interesting.
From spinach. And we like that idea around spinach because you're consuming those proteins already. They've been in your food supply since you were a baby, unless your mom didn't give you spinach, right? And so we looked at it as something that's already in the food system, something, proteins that are already being consumed. We found out with spinach defensins, there's no allergenicity or toxicity issues anywhere in all of our work. So we look at those as something that the food system. So we've looked at putting those proteins in a genetically engineered tree, and we do have that research going on, and we're working through the EPA and USDA regulatory procedures on that. But we looked at that could take longer than maybe the industry had to wait to get a GE tree out there. So we looked at Dr. Dawson's lab at the University of Florida, where he has taken the citrus distagia virus, which again is a virus that's in probably every tree in the world, every citrus tree in the world already has this virus in it. So it's endemic, and except for one rootstock, there's no detrimental issue to this virus. It just kind of lack of a better word, coexist with the citrus tree. So again, we're working with a virus that's always been in citrus.
Interesting.
Every tree in Florida's had citrus rutaceous virus in it. But what we found out about this virus, it actually likes to be manipulated. So Dr. Dawson has been able to take the spinach protein and insert it into the virus, and then we inoculate the tree with the virus, and the virus produces the spinach protein, which kills the citrus greening bacteria, which we hope will control the citrus greening bacteria. So it's a virus vector. So the tree is not genetically engineered at all. It's the same old tree that it's always been. You're not making a GE tree. You're making a biological
interesting
pesticide by taking a living organism to generate this protein. So it's very innovative, very forward-thinking, and that we think would probably be the first, if we can get through our proof of concept and find out that it has good tolerance, makes a tree tolerant to citrus greening, that would probably be the first product that would come out of our pipeline. So again, we have to work with USDA, AFIS-BRS, that part of the USDA on the CTV part because it's considered a plant pest, and we have to work with EPA on the protein that the CTV would be producing because that protein would be considered an active ingredient.
Sure. So are you ever amazed? Do you ever just sit back and go, I cannot believe this is even possible?
Yeah, most days Mike and I both get up going, boy, we've accomplished things that most people wouldn't even dreamed of, and being able to work with people like Dr. Dawson and Dr. Murkoff and you know, their thought process on how this could work, and then us being able to try to show it how it could actually work in commercial agriculture. It's actually been stimulating, it's been challenging.
Yeah.
The days you wake up and you go, oh, I think we can do this. And days you wake up going, well, it's research, right? Some days you're two steps forward and some days you're three steps back. That's all part of research and development.
Absolutely. Do you feel like, and some of the research that you're doing here, do you feel like we may be standing on a new edge of biological science, being able to do stuff like this and figure it out?
Well, I think the thought process definitely is. And again, we're very encouraged and confident that using a virus vector could change things in citrus, and it may be able to change things in other crops. And again, what we have tried, one of our strategies was, if we're going to do this, can we do it within what's already in the food system? Again, CTV being in just about every citrus tree in the world, we're not exposing that tree to anything that it hasn't seen before. And the same thing with spinach. We're not exposing a food system to anything it hasn't seen before. So that was our strategy, is to try to utilize what's already out there. That in itself is kind of innovative and forward thinking on the biotech field.
Yeah.
And then the next thing was exactly what you're saying. Take something like this virus vector inoculation that's never been done on widespread, and can we bring it to an industry that desperately needs a solution or a high tolerance to get our industry back on its foot? Sometimes we stand amazed quite often. You know, part of our research that we're doing is, how do these trees grow, and what's the best way to maximize the virus and maximize the protein so we control the bacteria. And even under a GE tree, if our GE tree with the spinach defensin comes out, our protein needs sulfur. So sulfur nutrition will have to change in a grove to provide the building blocks to make the protein to control the bacteria. And I think we're going to see the same thing with CRISPR technology. I think CRISPR technology will give us a degree of tolerance. I don't know if CRISPR technology will ever get us to resistance on greening, but we could complement a virus vector with the CRISPR technology, but both of those are going to need a totally different mindset on how you manage that grove with that technology to optimize what you're asking that plant to do.
Best case scenario, how long do you think it takes if everything goes through and you get through all these approvals? How long are you out? Are you out 5 years? Are you out 10 years till this hits groves?
We're out less than five on the CTV. A lot of it is getting comfortable with the technology and the efficacy, and then going through the regulatory process with what you're in. So that's really hard to say. It's research. We're hoping that our proof of concept trials that we have out now, we have two replicated trials in the state and plan on planning our third, mm-hmm. Our third and fourth. If those show us what we want, we can have something kind of near term. You know, being in R&D all my life and product development all my life, you hate to,
you hate to put a timeline on it.
As you develop, so timelines, you know, timelines are tough. But we're hoping to be able to address these things in the next couple to few years.
Tim, thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you.
It seems like the plant-based biotech industry is poised for more of these major discoveries. Now, just recently, I read about potential breakthroughs for cacao trees in their fight against fungal and plant diseases, currently killing up to a third of cocoa pods. New CRISPR technologies being used to knock out a gene that made the plants vulnerable, improving disease resistance. Now that work, it's being done here in the U.S. at Penn State University, where they have a research center dedicated to cacao and chocolate.
We're using a multi-prong approach. So one of the approaches is to support plant breeders with knowledge about the most important genes for disease resistance.
Mark Giltinan is professor of plant molecular biology at Penn State, and he's part of the team developing this new CRISPR approach. Why is this important that we take care of a disease like this?
The main reason is cacao diseases impact farmers in developing countries, farmers that are struggling daily to grow crops and to support their families, and up to 30 to 40% of their crop is lost annually due to pests and diseases. So one of our goals is to try to improve crops to be more resistant to diseases so that farmers have higher yields and higher incomes to help support their families.
Sure. Is there a risk of losing this getting worse and losing more of the crop globally?
Certainly there's a risk. One of the things we mostly worry about are diseases that might move between countries or even between continents. And cacao evolved in the Amazon, but it's been spread all the way around the world. And in each new country where it's been moved, there are new and unique diseases that have attacked this crop. Some of them have moved between countries and have caused really devastating effects. So definitely there's a risk of it becoming worse in the future. So we have to be ever diligent.
Let's talk about some of the research and kind of the interesting CRISPR research now that you're doing to try to save some of these crops and some of these trees around the globe. What's the approach and how are you, I don't know, taking this problem on?
Sure. So I'll turn this over to Drew Pfister and Lena Land here, who actually were the ones who carried out most of the work in the lab.
All right, Drew, why don't you tell us kind of about this project and how it came to be?
Sure. So the CRISPR-Cas9 technology has only been applied for maybe 5 or 6 years, and it's a tool that allows us to make very precise changes within the genes or the genome of plants or animal tissues that we're interested in studying. And so, as Mark mentioned earlier, we're interested in studying the genes involved in the immune system of cacao. So we're using CRISPR-Cas9 to study the function of some genes that we think are important in the plant's ability to protect itself from black pod rot.
As you worked on this project, was there anything that surprised you?
So when we started the experiment, we had some initial concerns that the method might not be very specific, which is to say that we're trying to make a change to a very specific site in the genome in this defense gene. And there's some concern that depending on the way the experiment is performed, that you might make changes in other places within the cacao genome. But we had an approach to test for this effect, and when we did that, we didn't detect any off-target effects. So we were sort of surprised and relieved to see that the experiment worked in the specific way that we were hoping it would.
Lena Landhier's also been working on that. And Lena, what did you see from this research that you thought was interesting or maybe might even be new to the world of plant biology research?
I think it's the opportunity to use these tools and to speed up the process that's so fascinating. We're able to look and evaluate much more thoroughly the science in the laboratory and evaluate these specific genes and see if they do have an effect, allowing foresight for researchers and breeders to then target those genes and know their ultimate effect in for the crop.
Is using CRISPR technology more difficult or easier than some of the things that you've been doing probably for the last few decades in this realm?
I think it's with every new technology, there's advantages and disadvantages, and there are some key advantages to using CRISPR. And so that's why everybody is looking at it as a new tool to working and using it with other tools that have other advantages. So, again, we're keeping open-minded to all the approaches available and using them appropriately.
Drew, I'll go back to you. Now that you've done some of this, you've written a paper about it, I assume you feel good about where the research stands. What do you hope is accomplished here?
Well, the gene that we studied using CRISPR-Cas9 appears to be a major regulator of the plant's ability to protect itself from disease. So now that we've verified that this gene is so important, we can start translating that information by studying existing cocoa trees, looking for variation in the activity of this gene to try to find plants that may have naturally heightened immunity just because of the sort of natural variants of this gene in cocoa populations.
Ciela Maximova, research professor of plant biotechnology, also at Penn State. This is a pretty important crop for a lot of parts of the world.
Yes, it is. Well, for us in the developed world and on the consumer part, chocolate is really important because we all love it and it's embedded in our culture. But from a development perspective, chocolate is grown in some of the poorest country in the world, including Ghana and Ivory Coast, which produce more than 70% of all the cacao beans in the world, plus all the countries in Latin America, Caribbean, and Asia. So it's a widespread belt on the equator that produces cacao, and in some of the countries, it's one of the most important cash crops that contributes to the income of those countries.
Are you excited, maybe that's the right word, about where the future of this type of research can take us in battling diseases and being able to maintain crops for these farmers that, you know, this is their livelihood. This is how they feed their families.
For us, using technology and very advanced research is one of the main objectives. And the lab is focused on utilizing all modern tools so we can increase the potential and create new varieties of cacao, which I think personally is the best way to improve the productivity in the cacao plantations. Cacao farmers are very poor, very small in the majority of the countries and in the majority of the cases where cacao is produced. They don't have access to inputs, they don't have access to tools, and they don't have access to financing. So in our traditional way of thinking about agriculture in the U.S., where you have machinery and you can apply fertilizer and you can have an integrated system of agriculture.
Right. We have a whole system. Yeah, we have a whole system built here for people.
That's right. And we also have different ways to integrate this system to achieve maximum productivity. The farmers in the cacao world don't have that option. So having good plants with really good genetics, is one of their best ways to tackle these problems.
Speaking of new techniques and research,
the plant is going to assimilate these inputs that are there already to produce more grain yield. And so it's a, you know, even more simply said, it's a yield trait at the end of the day.
That's Matthew Criss, CEO of Benson Hill Biosystems. His company and Bex Hybrids will soon start selling seeds with a first ever photosynthetic efficiency trait, allowing plants to better utilize sunlight, which they say will help increase yields and profitability. Matthew, this is new to me. I've never heard anything quite like it.
Yeah, so this is a trait that Benson Hill has been developing for the last 6 years, really since the company was founded in 2012. And it's a very difficult area of research that some folks over the last 20 years or more have actually taken a look at. And many of the large ag biotech companies that we're all aware of. But uh-huh. You know, it's a trait that is allowing us to improve primary metabolism and specifically the photosynthetic efficiency or capacity of corn plants, so that it captures more atmospheric carbon and then uses what nature gave it, which are the tools to combine that with water and sunlight and ultimately create more grain yield.
That's really interesting. This seems like something that's a pretty tough code to crack. How did you guys do it?
Sure. Well, I think it really boiled up from being able to use computation and really the convergence of computation or what we might say is machine intelligence combined with human intelligence.
Interesting.
And so Benson Hill was really founded on the principle that if we could use large-scale data, computation, and then again, human intelligence to look at the problem quite differently than it has been looked at historically. And by doing so, we were able to triangulate maybe a lot more quickly and certainly for a lot less cost on some ideas, some hypotheses that we began testing, like I said, several years ago. And that's really led today to a very robust pipeline, a portfolio of photosynthesis trait candidates.
Ah, interesting. So what is the end result here for the farmer? So a lot of farmers probably going to be listening to this and saying, okay, what does this mean once I get it planted in my field? What will I see?
You know, the goal here is not to make any change to what a grower is doing. So a grower is going to plant at the same density. They're going to purchase seed the same way. They're not going to change anything, but by virtue of having more, I'll call it metabolic capacity, the plant is going to assimilate these inputs, and no more inputs, by the way. I mean, it doesn't require any more nitrogen, doesn't require any more water, but it's going to assimilate these inputs that are there already to produce more grain yield. And so it's a, you know, even more simply said, it's a yield trait at the end of the day.
Is it a 3% bump? Is it a 5% bump? Do you know that number yet?
Well, we never know the precise number because the traits are always going to behave slightly different in different environmental conditions. What we've found to be very promising is that we've seen across a very diverse set of environmental conditions across multiple years and across a lot of different genetic backgrounds, a consistent yield increase that's in that, I'll call it mid to upper single digit percentages. And so, you know, we roughly will say 5 to 10% as an indicator today, but that'll become more refined and more geographically specific as the trait gets trialed even further and developed over the next 3 to 5 years.
Does this fall under a biotech trait or is this more of a biological advancement?
Well, it's a biological advancement, certainly, but we do call it a biotech trait.
Okay.
It'll be a regulated article. We'll be going through, and already are, in fact, the regulatory procedures with the USDA to make sure that it doesn't have any type of adverse effects, both on the plant system and the ecosystem.
So as you look out into the future, and I know this is your business, you're looking for new and innovative ways, I think a lot of people would say to hack the systems of some of our plants and our food plants. What do you see out there in the future that is possible? What's possible today?
Yeah, sure. It's a great question. We look at the natural genetic diversity of plants and continue to just be astonished at the diversity that exists in species that are known to be grown today for food and feed and fuel, but also that aren't today grown for
right.
food and feed and fuel. And that, we think, provides probably the single most interesting opportunity long-term for our food and agriculture system. We, through new tools like genome editing, can begin to harness the natural genetic potential of plants in ways that we really couldn't have imagined a decade ago. And I think over the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to see enormous strides towards helping not just companies like Benson Hill, but many companies that today aren't considered, say, innovative or don't have extremely strong technical acumen, helping them discover how to employ those tools in ways that, create more choice, more profitability ultimately, both at the grower level, but also for consumers. But for consumers, I mean, more choice, more healthy options, additional and very diverse solutions that it can be consumed on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, absolutely. As you look out and try to see what's next, are we looking at like disease resistance? Are we looking at, metabolic boosters? Are we looking at, any other kind of traits that you think may be on the horizon?
Absolutely. And those are good examples where, you could say the yield trait that we're discussing and for which we have a pipeline, is a metabolic booster. I think that's fair. Disease resistance, stress tolerance, that plants are experiencing in, volatile environmental conditions. These are the tip of the iceberg for mm-hmm. what natural genetic diversity can offer us. And, they exist already. Plants are extremely innovative and, over time have developed, tools and approaches that, we are just beginning to understand. And as I think we harness more data and biological feedback from these systems, and there's more collaborative approaches to innovate in our community amongst both companies and academic institutions and farmers, the possibilities are really, really promising.
I know you do this as a career, right? You're running this company. You guys are moving a million miles an hour trying to come up with the next innovation. Why do you do this? Where's your passion for this? Why did you decide, I'm going to get into this business and see what we can do and why we can impact the world?
I appreciate you asking that. I'm not from this industry. I'm not a scientist or an engineer. I come from, the investment space, where I had an opportunity to look for several years at a lot of tools and technologies that were being used in life sciences and for human health. And when you begin to look at agriculture and food, you start to realize that we're really underutilizing a lot of the next generation tools that are already being employed in human health. And I just became very passionate when you look at the needs of this industry and the global importance of this industry and the impact really on human health. Right. And in a way
sure.
that starts, before we're even born, the impact, the degree of impact that you can have by working on and improving the food and agriculture system is immense. And, I've really fallen in love with it. I think it's got a collaborative feel and there's a lot of white space to innovate. And we're really, dedicating ourselves to helping empower that.
Have you been surprised by the speed of success?
Well, you know,
I know 6 years probably doesn't feel like speed, but you know what I'm saying. I mean, actually, people work decades and years on some of this stuff.
Sure. Well, you know, I think it's fair to say that we've been able, through taking innovative approaches and using new technologies, and frankly, having hired a terrific team, we've been able to move more quickly than most folks have moved, maybe ever moved, in developing these types of approaches and tools. I think you can say surprised. That's an okay way to put it. But I'd say, to kind of further that thought, I don't yet think we fully understand how quickly we can move. Mm. You know, there are other approaches that we're beginning to explore, that we're beginning to take, that will allow us and other innovators to use these types of approaches, these types of data, these types of decision support tools for breeders, you know, to innovate and to develop products even quicker for even less cost. And so while I'm pleased that we've done what we've done in the time that we've done it, I think that we can always do better. And I think that it'll be a far more powerful movement when the community as a unit stands up and develops, you know, more prolifically than what we've seen historically.
You know, there's a lot of farmers out there, not all of them, but there are a lot of farmers out there that are constantly looking to say, oh, what could I tweak? How could I work on this? What could I do to improve,
right,
you know, from an efficiency standpoint or from, you know, a technology standpoint or what have you? I mean, I just feel like there's a hunger for that kind of technology and innovation.
I enjoy the dialogue with farmers who see themselves as true innovators, who want to embrace the notion that their world doesn't need to revolve around corn and beans. I would encourage that line of thinking, because I think when we talk about things, it's easy to talk about, you know, choice and profitability in the context of corn, which, you know, we're helping you know, become more sustainable and provide more ultimate productivity. But extrapolate that to, you know, a couple dozen or more additional crops that will be grown in the coming years, and that provides a whole new paradigm of profitability that we think this kind of technology is going to enable at the grower level. You know, I offer that comment simply because, you know, you see a lot of folks that, you know, are driving in the direction to improve the existing system as it sits today, and then you've got, if you look farther down the value chain, the consumer who is forcing the system to change in ways that we probably didn't predict 5 or 10 years ago. And we see that as an opportunity holistically for the value chain. And I think growers are also beginning to understand that, you know, this means that there are great days to come.
Matthew, thank you so much for taking time to visit and tell us about some of the work that you guys are doing.
Well, thank you for the time. It's a pleasure to join you.
Well, this is just a couple of days worth of major news stories. And as technology and understanding of the biological world improves, it's no doubt we'll see more of these types of announcements. America and the world's farm stakeholders will continue to push to solve crises like they did with the potato blights or boll weevil of the past. Scientists today are poised to unlock and unleash the natural world's defenses in a way that we've never seen or scarcely could have imagined. It's going to be interesting. We all need to sit down and enjoy the ride. Thanks for listening. For the Farm Sense Podcast, I'm Clint Griffiths. We'll see you soon on AgPay.